from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. forces struck at the heart of the Iraqi regime today. More than 70 tanks and 60 Bradley fighting vehicles rumbled deep into Baghdad. British forces now hold most of Basra. The hostilities phase is coming to a conclusion, Colin Powell said today. This war isn't won yet. But there's a sense that the end game is at least in sight tonight on Point, wrapping up the war and the dangerous zone ahead between war and peace. We begin with U.S. troops bedding down tonight inside Baghdad in the palace grounds of Saddam Hussein. Jules Crittenden is a correspondent for the Boston Herald with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. U.S. commanders said today, after we spoke with Jules, that his unit is among the first that have gone into Baghdad that will stay in the city and hold their position. I asked Jules Crittenden to describe the scene for us.
Right now it's just after nightfall. I'm about probably a quarter of a mile from one of Saddam's palaces in a palace district, which the battalion 464 armor rolled into today. In fact, right in front of me is what I take to be one of these Iranian war memorials. It's 4 soldiers, 1 dead, 1 looks like he might be dying, and 2 others are being heroic. This is an intersection next to a bridge over the Tigris, and there was a lot of Iraqi infantry sort of dug in around here. On the whole road coming in, they didn't put up the kind of fight that was expected. There was sort of a lot of harassing fire with RPGs and AKs, but no casualties that I'm aware of on the American side. Quite a lot of EPWs and soldiers killed on the Iraqi side. Part of the company is up there camped out in one of Saddam's palaces. And this great big edifice that has 3 massive busts of Saddam wearing some sort of Genghis Khan hat. It's like one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen.
Jules, so does that mean you are in or near the center of Baghdad, and are these American troops intending to spend the night there?
We are spending the night here. We are in a palatial sort of residential district, almost what you could call a gated community for, I have to imagine, only the most senior Ba'ath Party members and Saddam himself. It's pretty much entirely deserted except for the soldiers who've all been either killed or carted away. But yeah, we're at a bend in the Tigris. If you look at the map, there's a bend that sort of, an oxbow that kind of points to the northeast. Mm-hmm. And that's where this area is. And we're here. There has not been any sort of a serious counterattack. It's very quiet right now.
Jules, do you know if the troops you're with intend now to hold this position, or is this another dive into Baghdad and nip back out again operation?
I don't have a good answer to that. I know that we're here overnight, and I don't know if their intention is to stay, but I'm not aware of any plans to leave at this point. I understand that the prior 2 raids were pretty much in and out, but there is at this point what's a pretty peaceful presence here that has not been seriously challenged.
Jules Crittenden, how much urban area did you travel through to get to these palaces, and what kind of resistance or lack thereof did you find?
It's hard to judge distances. We probably went through about 5 miles or so of suburbs and so forth. All along the way, there was sort of sporadic resistance, but it was essentially infantry dealing with an armor battalion coming through. So they were being essentially shot to pieces whenever they tried anything. There was a tremendous amount of suppressing fire, destroying of any military vehicles and military equipment along the way. As we got into this huge palace complex, which is the equivalent of, like, say, the whole Back Bay or something like that, it's a large area.
In Boston.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of soldiers sort of in little positions in among the hedges and so forth on the side of the road, tree-lined road, and they were putting up quite a bit of fire, but again, they were suppressed pretty quickly.
Are U.S. troops now inside the palace facilities? Have they cleared those out?
Yep. I'm actually located at a square, you know, this intersection. I'm with the PSYOPs guys who were playing surrender or stay away. You know, to the civilians, it's like stay away. We don't want to hurt you kind of messages in Arabic. Mm-hmm. So I haven't actually been into the palace itself, although, yes, they are within the grounds of a palace. they have gone through a palace, which is this massive structure I described. I don't know if they're actually staying inside it, camped out inside it or not, but they are on the grounds of one of his palaces. I didn't have a chance to go in because I was doing other things. I'm told that it's palatial. It has a lot of marble and all the dressings, but apparently it's brand new and has not been occupied, and there's not like a lot of furnishings and so forth. And the vehicle that I was in, which was a 113, one of those old personnel carriers, open up the hatch and everybody can stick out the top. So I had a good view. We did a sweep through the entire area. We were going around ornamental lakes with little rowboats and ducks swimming on them. The GIs were looking at those like, oh, God, I'd just love to jump in and get clean because we're all
filthy,
completely filthy.
A lot of soldiers talked about the road home being through Baghdad. Now they're there in a palace in Baghdad. What's the mood? Do the U.S. troops you're with feel like they're nearer to getting home?
That specifically we haven't talked about because they do expect to play a role of sort of an army of occupation for some time before they rotate out. But there is a lot of, I'd say, sort of bemusement. It was easier than they thought. There was concern about heavy street fighting. And for all we know, I mean, tonight is quiet, but tonight has only just begun.
Right.
And there's a lot of talk of, well, like here we are in Baghdad. You know, it's kind of weird. Here we are parked on his very doorstep. And the sense is we own this place in the sense that this is not being challenged. And here we are at last. So I think everybody feels a little odd about it. It's like when, you suddenly turn, say, 30, and there you are, you're 30, but guess what? You're not that different than you were the day before, if you know what I'm saying, you know.
Alas,
because
I do.
because it was not a hard-fought battle. So we've talked about it quite a bit during the day, about the fact that we're here, and I think that they're kind of savoring the moment.
Jules Crittenden is correspondent for the Boston Herald with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. He spoke with us earlier from near the grounds of a presidential palace inside Baghdad where U.S. troops have dug in tonight. There may be hard and ugly fighting ahead, but the word today from Colin Powell is that the hostilities phase in Iraq is coming to a conclusion. But that does not mean easy street for Iraqis or for U.S. troops who must soon make a delicate transition from war-making to peacemaking. Tonight on Point, wrapping up the war and the looming murky zone between war and peace. How does the U.S. make the transition from war to peace? How long are you comfortable seeing American GIs policing Iraq? And is a replay of post-war Afghanistan good enough for Iraq? Or is something better required? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is retired Army Brigadier General John Ruppert. He's Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening. Great to have you, General Ruppert.
Thank you very much.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Daryl Press, Professor of Government at Dartmouth College and Consultant to the Defense Department on Military Planning for the Persian Gulf. Good evening and welcome, Daryl Press.
Good evening.
Daryl Press, John Ruppert, here we are. Troops sleeping tonight on the grounds of Saddam Hussein's, of one of his many palaces. But tonight, notably, inside Baghdad, no longer on the perimeter. Colin Powell, we hear saying today that we're coming to the conclusion of the hostilities phase. We're going to look at how this is going to be wrapped up. But General Ruppert, let me turn to you first. Are you comfortable with this phrasing? Does it feel to you, in fact, like we're coming to the conclusion of hostilities? We want to look tonight at what that turn from war-making to peacemaking may look like and feel like, but are you confident that that's where we are?
I have tremendous respect for Secretary Powell, but I would not have used the term the end of hostilities. Hostilities has at least three aspects. The first is what we've been dealing with to date, and that is organized military resistance.
Mm-hmm.
We have dealt with that effectively, and that phase is, in fact, coming to an end. We will be through a phase of hostilities in terms of individual snipers, suicide bombers, and others for some period of time. But the real hostility that we have to overcome to be successful in this effort is in the attitude of the people toward foreigners on their land. If we can overcome that kind of hostility, we can truly be effective in setting up an Iraqi government that will survive.
And Darrell Press, is there a military plan in place? I mean, it was clearly the Pentagon planned to win the war-fighting portion of this. That meant they knew, of course, they would have to make a turn to something different than the kind of all-out campaign we've seen coming up from Kuwait. What does that kind of turn look like? And how do we deal maybe even simultaneously with these three things that General Ruppert describes? Active broad fighting in some areas, more narrow fighting in others, and in others, a kind of PR challenge.
I think the general's comments are exactly right. We still are in a phase of active hostility, and in fact, there might even be substantial more organized resistance in parts of Baghdad. What the Army and Marines have been doing over the past 48 hours is moving into parts of the city. For example, the Army is in the center of Baghdad, but there are broad parts of the city, especially parts with some narrow streets, some old parts of town, where we haven't even ventured in yet, and so we might be facing organized resistance. While dealing with that, I think you're exactly right that we will start transitioning into the next phase of the mission, which will be to start taking upon ourselves the principal functions of government, the most fundamental functions of government in Baghdad. For example, we will become responsible for making sure that there is electricity and water going to the civilians. We will become responsible for protecting the streets from rioting and looting and violence, and ultimately responsible for making sure that humanitarian aid gets to those who need it and the humanitarian aid convoys themselves are protected. So we will probably be doing both the end of hostilities and, you know, the beginning of government simultaneously.
Darrell Press, how does that work on the ground where U.S. troopers are? Does a signal come down from high command saying, you've been war fighting, now you're peacekeeping? Or is it how does it literally unfold? Is there a change in standing orders? Do people put their guns safeties on? Do you know what I mean? How does it play out?
Well, hopefully the triggering event will be a surrender. And if this happened, then I think the way this would play out is that some senior member of the current Iraqi government, somebody with a great deal of legitimacy in Iraq, will stand up, sign some piece of paper, and most importantly, tell the Iraqi loyalists and regime loyalists to put down their arms and stop fighting. And that won't necessarily end all hostilities, but hopefully that would be the turning point. If we don't get such a surrender, if nobody stands up and does this, then it will probably be an even more gradual process where U.S. forces continue to try to root out loyalists. And maybe what we'll end up doing is bring in our own Iraqi government to surrender, namely the provisional Iraqi government that we will help to organize might be the one that ends up having to surrender.
And General Ruppert, how do you see this playing out on the ground? Obviously, there'll be different levels of hostility in different parts of Iraq. There are already. Some are fairly well pacified. Others are not. Do soldiers get a direct order from the commanding officer saying, in our area, in our zone, circumstances have changed, your focus is now on policing instead of war fighting? Or is it just called by each soldier on a moment-by-moment basis?
Well, it's certainly not called by each soldier, and Darrell described correctly what the system is. What really happens, at least in my experience, is you have different types of units that have different missions. The psychological affairs unit that you had talked about earlier in the show, there are civil affairs units. Mm-hmm. These people, while they are capable of war fighting, have a primary mission of establishing civil services within the society and working with the locals. They are better equipped with linguists to handle these kind of challenges in terms of distributing humanitarian aid and so forth. So you have units working in parallel. The war fighters will maintain readiness, provide security, but the transition in primary responsibility will go to those people with other missions.
But just in the minute we have left, there's not a kind of sharp decision or differentiation. We know U.S. troops have been trained in peacekeeping. Even warfighters are trained in peacekeeping. There's no signal that goes out, we're flipping now.
Well, if you have a signed document, as was said, then that's pretty easy. You know that the rules have changed, and then you're dealing with hostilities from illegals rather than representatives of the government.
And I guess you hope the rules have changed. I mean, the top thing may have changed, but whether or not that filters down or not is another story. That's the phase we're talking about tonight, about wrapping up the war and the zone between war and peace to come. You can join the conversation. How does the United States turn the corner from war-making to peacekeeping, from invaders, liberators, to police? And how long are you comfortable seeing American GIs policing Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about wrapping up the war in Iraq and the zone to come between war and peace as U.S. troops face a new phase. Whether it's here or not, it's coming. Does it seem to you that U.S.-led forces are now wrapping up the war? And what's harder, taking Baghdad or restarting Iraq? How can Iraq be pushed toward a new peace and not toward guerrilla war? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests are Daryl Press, joining us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire. He's professor of government at Dartmouth College and has been a consultant to the Defense Department on fighting in the Persian Gulf. And retired Brigadier General, U.S. Army General John Ruppert, Executive Director of Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. There's a lot I want to ask about here as we get into this next phase. I want to look at wrapping up, and I know that's a big project in itself, at avoiding a tale of guerrilla war on this war. And finally, who gets arrested, who gets picked up, how all that works. But let's look first at this issue of wrapping up. It's easy to say and hard to do, John Ruppert. In your mind, in broad terms, what does a wrapping up to this war look like?
Well, the first part that you would look for in wrapping up is making the streets safe for normal commerce, normal traffic, normal activities by the population, not necessarily for the armed forces, but for the population at large. If the markets reopen, if the schools reopen, if business is resumed in the marketplace, then you know that you have the confidence of the population that the war, from their perspective, is over. Mm-hmm. Then you can isolate those individuals that have chosen a different path and deal with them individually.
So just for that phase, Daryl Press, what does that look like in your mind, getting to the point where Iraqis, including Baghdad residents, feel comfortable going to the markets, going to school?
Well, I think the most important step in that direction is making them feel that they're going to be safe operating, making sure they feel safe walking around the streets. And so that means preventing looting, preventing rioting, preventing acts of retribution and acts of violence.
And before that, even being sure that the Republican Guard is still not in a big cellar somewhere in Baghdad, I guess.
That's exactly right. But my guess is that the people will be very eager to get out of their basements and start resuming their normal lives. And the main thing we have to do to facilitate that is provide security in the streets of Baghdad. That would be a first step in my mind.
I would just add another point on that, though, and that the wonderful advantages in queuing off the civilian population is they know if the Republican Guards are in the basement. We don't know that in all cases, but they aren't going to walk on the streets. They won't be confident. So when they come out and start behaving normally, it's because they know their setting better than we do.
Well, do they really? Does anybody really know whether and if there's a final core of Saddam loyalist troops somewhere in Baghdad or outside? Do civilians even know that, John Ruppert?
The civilians won't know what's going on the macro scale, but they know their neighborhoods very well.
Mm-hmm.
They know if there are basements occupied. They know if there are people with guns in adjacent houses. And they know if there is a potential for hostilities because it is their family members who are involved in this.
And Daryl Press, as we head into this shoot toward the end, somewhere out there, how should U.S. forces proceed to minimize the chances that there will be a guerrilla war, however long or short, that follows the major body of the war?
Ultimately, I think that the main things we have to do to reduce the probability of guerrilla war or civil war in Iraq has to do with assuring the various competing groups in Iraq that they all will have a stake in the future. And this will not be a simple task because the Kurds in Iraq, who've been living in virtual autonomy in northern Iraq for the last, I guess, 6 or 7 years now, will have to be convinced to stay in Iraq that they will not be now subject to very strong rule from the Shiite Arabs or from the Sunni Arabs in the south. So they have to be convinced to stay in Iraq. The Shiites have to be obviously given an awful lot of power, given that they're the majority. But you also have to convince the Sunnis that they're not going to be treated too badly, that they won't be the victims of just broad and wide-scale retribution. So my sense is that the most important step will be diplomatic and political to try to convince people in Iraq that they will have a stake, that they will be safe and have a chance for prosperity in the future of Iraq.
General Ruppert, from what you've seen, from what we've all watched so far, do you think that this is a doable task? Do you expect some kind of underground to go on after the main body of the war has gone by that will surface occasionally or constantly with attacks, whether by units or by individuals?
I don't expect that from units. I think that we can expect for maybe a year or so that individuals will be involved. There are a number of individuals that don't have the option of being part of the peaceful structure of the society. They would be labeled as war criminals by their own people. They would be arrested by their own people if they made themselves available. And so their option is to hide and hunt and to be the renegades within the society because the open door is closed for them.
We're talking tonight about the zone between war and peace that looks like it's looming ahead. Colin Powell calls today, says the hostilities phase is coming to an end. My guests tonight say, be careful, don't jump on that coming to an end too quickly. There's a lot more work to be done, but it's out there. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Talib is calling from Boston. Hi, Talib, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Loving your program. Just have two comments and just a few of the discussion. One, I think we're a bit moving a bit too much prematurely when we say that the end of hostilities are near. I know that when we fought the war in Vietnam, we were a bit surprised when people we thought were on our side just turned out not to be. So I think it would be too premature to let our guard down. So that's kind of like the first thing I want to say. The second thing is if we want to win over the hearts and minds, I really think that we should start with rebuilding the religious structures that may have been destroyed or damaged through our invasion, occupation, and so forth, and then rebuilding some of the key infrastructure before building in the business, because there's already a sense within that region that capitalism is an evil. So to start with capitalism would kind of still turn them against us.
So start with very clearly public-spirited projects, you're saying, Talib.
Yeah, public. Because, I really think we have a finely trained military, and I think that they are capable of rebuilding the infrastructure that is more culturally centered. And if they went that route first, I think they could win some more hearts and minds.
Interesting perspective, and thanks for your call, Talib. Darrell Press, let me put it to you first. I guess on the first part of this, we asked General Ruppert earlier, but let me put it to you. Is it possible that there's a real kind of false bottom in this suitcase, that we may be lulled into the sense that we've got this licked or we've broken the back of it, and then turn around a day, a week, a month later, and find ourselves in real fighting again?
I think it is at least possible in the sense that the good news in this situation from our standpoint is that an awful lot of people in Iraq really hate Saddam and his regime. The bad news is that hatred of Saddam might mask a fair amount of anti-Americanism and resentment against us. So some of the people dancing in the streets who are very happy to be liberated might decide in 6 or 9 months or even in a week that while they hated Saddam, now they want to get rid of us. And I think that the sorts of things we've already talked about and that Talib mentions will be essential in order to convince the Iraqi people that whether or not they love us, that if they simply don't become guerrillas, that Iraq will become a better place for them in the matter of a few months.
Mm-hmm. And General Ruppert, what's your level of confidence that the Pentagon, where the post-war rebuilding project currently seems to be centered, is focused with this kind of nuanced attention on A, B, and C steps that might be taken to raise the likelihood of winning popular support?
I think they understand that very well. We have, unfortunately, had a lot of combat experiences in different places in which that was critical. Talib mentioned one thing, though. I would like to raise the question, because I think that we could encounter some real troubles if you send in essentially Christian troops to build mosques for Muslims. I think that the Muslims would have some question about that, and perhaps I'm wrong. I would hope so. But I know what the military is focused on initially, and that is what Professor Press pointed out in the beginning, making sure that the water flows through the pipes, making sure the electricity runs through the wires, making sure the communication services back up, the bridges and the roads are usable, and it is possible to reestablish normal life within the society.
And from what we hear so far, that's what Iraqis are asking for, electricity, water, the basics. Interesting point about how they want American troops to interact with religious sites. We saw some pushback against that just last week as they got even close to sites in some holy cities. General Ruppert, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Marina Ottaway. She's senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Democracy and Rule of Law Project. Good evening and welcome, Marina Ottaway.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. You have looked at this kind of hinge moment where the U.S. military goes from primarily fighting to primarily rebuilding and peacemaking. What's at the top of your list for what the U.S. military needs to be thinking about if and when, or when, it turns that corner, Marine Ottaway?
I think one very important issue, which I have not heard mentioned too much in the course of the previous conversation, is for the U.S. to start working as much as possible with, to start identifying and working with community leaders. And those come from all sorts of walks of life. I mean, for example, it's very important to a normal life to reopen the markets, to reopen the shops. I think working with, you know, whoever controls the local markets may be a very important issue. School teachers or school principals, essentially, in trying to get some cooperation within the community and people who are respected within the community who may be cooperating with us in reestablishing a normal pattern of life.
Marina Ottaway, what's your sense of the reality in Iraq? Is there a vibrant or just viable community leadership after all these years of Saddam Hussein's domination and domination by the Ba'ath Party? Is it there for the U.S. and others to link arms with?
I think there are individuals who emerge as leaders in all these situations if they are given a chance. I mean, one thing that we learn, for example, in the United States during in that very bad time of race riots in the United States is that very often leadership emerge to take the situation in hand and to deal as a go-between between the police and the people who are actually rioting. And in many ways, I think it would be a very important task is that of trying to identify, trying to help the emergence of such individuals who can become essentially local leaders and helping reestablish some sort of orders, prevent looting, and so on. A strong U.S. military presence in the streets of Baghdad is certainly important, but you also need people who can get some cooperation from the population and therefore some support for a more peaceful outcome.
General Press, this task the military faces of sorting out the community leaders from the bad guys is clearly going to be a difficult one. We read on the front page of the Wall Street Journal this morning this amazing story of the U.S. military having been informed that a certain Shiite leader was a strong supporter of Saddam Hussein. They went, they broke into his compound, they took him and a dozen or more of his supporters away to a U.S. military camp, and within an hour, a big, angry mob of locals was there saying, let this man go. He's our defender against Saddam. Is the military equipped to make these kind of sometimes razor-fine distinctions about Iraqis?
It's such a hard problem that not only will the military have a problem with that, even the regional specialists in the State Department and in all parts of the U.S. government are going to have trouble with that. You know, we saw similar difficulties in Afghanistan trying to figure out who were the real Taliban leaders and who were the al-Qaeda supporters and who were not. And what unfortunately happened on several occasions is people on the ground in Afghanistan used our desire to get rid of Taliban sympathizers as a way of score settling.
So they would label a personal enemy as Taliban.
Exactly. And so our biggest source of intelligence on the ground once we transfer over to a peacekeeping sort of situation is, as General Ruppert, I think, suggested earlier, is likely to be the people of Baghdad themselves. But the problem with that is while some of them will have an interest in helping us, there's also going to be score settling and lying and figuring out who's a community leader who is really in bed with the Ba'ath Party and who's one who is only acting like they were so they could protect their community. That's going to be a very, very challenging task.
And once that peacekeeping begins, policing against the score settling you described could in itself make enemies for U.S. forces. Douglas is calling from Albany, New York. Hi, Douglas. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I'm taking a total different viewpoint, and I'll tell you where I feel about this. First of all, I'd like to know when nations that conquered another nation previous to World War II turned the nation back to the conquered nation and then walked away from it. My feeling is, first of all, they should pay every single dime back Iraq that cost us for going in there and cleaning up their mess. And they should pay back every one of the families who have a killed soldier for helping them to get their freedom. The other thing, you know, I'm online with George Bush and some of these Republicans, that they shouldn't just stop here, that this is not going to be rooted out just by cleaning up and going in and getting rid of Saddam Hussein. the politics and the religious aspect of this is much deeper. You know, I marvel at the fact that the Germans were put back in charge of the World Bank. I wonder how my father would have felt, who was a World War II veteran, after he walked across France and Germany and then had to liberate France and go in and fight his way through Germany.
But, Douglas, wasn't the point there and now in Iraq to ultimately get back to the point where nations live in a community of nations, where they're no longer enemies?
Well, you know what? The way they don't become our enemy is don't give it back to them right away.
I don't know if that's on anybody's agenda this time, but we've got your point. Marina Ottaway, here's a call for conquest, but that's exactly the word Washington has been desperately trying to avoid.
Well, I think it was not just a call for conquest. It was also a call for revenge and retribution. And what we have learned after World War I is that is the wrong way to go about it, because the humiliation of Germany after World War I certainly helped us set the stage for what happened later. So I think the idea of trying to make Iraq pay for the cost of the war would be a terrible idea.
But still, Paul Wolfowitz is saying, Paul Wolfowitz is saying it's going to be at least 6 months of essentially what sounds like U.S. Military overseen administration of Iraq. Do we have that long in Iraq, Marina Ottaway? Can the United States be there for 6 months or more and not have Iraqis turn against the American presence?
No, I think it cannot, and that is why I think it's very important that the UN be given an important role here, because there is no way in 6 months to have a stable Iraqi government that can control that country by itself. But staying in a long time for the United States would cause a tremendous backlash.
So Tom, can I jump in here? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, Darrell Press, please.
I think that there's a question at the heart of what Douglas said, which on one level sounds very, very reasonable, which is I think a lot of people think like Douglas and ask the question that says, why are we treating Iraq with such kid gloves? You know, back in the olden days when you conquered Germany, you weren't so careful about civilians. You didn't immediately give them their government back. You weren't making promises to them right away. Why are we dealing with this so differently? And I think it's an absolutely fair question, but I do think there's an answer. The answer to me is that in the war against Germany in World War II, we weren't fundamentally worried about the views of German-speaking people and ethnic German people all around the world. We didn't feel like the prize was the hearts and minds of the world's German people. In this war, Iraq is not really the prize. The prize is, how will 1 billion Muslims think about America?
And that's a big prize and a big issue. We've got to take a short break. Darrell Press, John Ruppert, please stand by. Marina Ottaway, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Marina Ottaway is senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We're talking about wrapping up the war and the zone between war and peace. To come is a replay of post-war Afghanistan. Good enough this time. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about wrapping up the war in Iraq and the zone between war and peace. To come, you can join the conversation. What is America's obligation to Iraq in the next phase of war and peace? What is Iraq's obligation? And how long are you comfortable seeing American GIs policing Iraq? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Darrell Press from Dartmouth College and John Ruppert, retired Brigadier General in the U.S. Army. Steve's calling right now from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
In approaching the problem in Iraq, I just suggest that we look at the other side of the Middle East and maybe pick up two ideas that are really very prominent there.
Okay.
The first is of a roadmap. And
as in Israeli-Palestinian, that hasn't gone very far yet, Steve.
No, it hasn't, but we have a potentially different situation here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to have a certain set of milestones as to how long various phases are going to last, when it will end, and what the ultimate outcome would be. And that might really help assuage a lot of anxiety about American ambitions and intentions.
So by such and such a date, we will turn over these resources, these powers, and so on.
That's right. And I'm thinking also of, a constitutional convention. Say, after 6 months, we will have a constitutional convention with representatives elected in such a fashion.
You know, of course, in Japan, Americans essentially wrote the Constitution and handed it to them.
That's right. And maybe, I don't know if what the roadmap would be, but there is a sense of what the stages would be and when, again, resources would be transferred, when power would be transferred.
It's an interesting idea, Steve. Let me put it to General John Ruppert. Let's look at these 6 months and what needs to be accomplished. Steve's, you know, this is kind of right out of your B-school playbook. You know, have deliverables by certain dates. Can we apply that kind of model to the nation of Iraq? And how do you see these 6 months or more unfolding?
Because of the uncertainty of the security situation, I don't think that assigning dates is the best strategy. I think it is possible to set a series of goals and that you can build on the next goal having accomplished the first one. And the types of steps that he was talking about are quite reasonable so that the Iraqis can see how they get to each stage by accomplishing the intermediate steps. I think that's a good philosophy.
And what about, Daryl Press, this issue of the first project of policing, which is to go after individuals that the United States defines as war criminals? I'm reading today out of Washington, American plans to conduct trials of Iraqis alleged to have committed war crimes. And, of course, they've got Saddam Hussein and his two sons in there, but then they have kind of unnamed group in three areas. They said they're going to try those who were party to putting American dead American soldiers on Iraqi television, those who were party to airing scenes, humiliating scenes, as they described them, of American POWs, and those who were party to what they describe as the perfidy of false surrenders, white flags that turned into attacks. How do you imagine the military going after war criminals, Daryl Press?
Well, ultimately, that's going to be a policing and intelligence operation. That will be, I think, as General Ruppert said, once hostilities in an organized fashion end, then what you're really dealing with are criminals and not military situations. So my guess is that you will either have checkpoints, and when you'll be matching up pictures of people who are wanted against the faces of people at checkpoints. You'll be investigating claims by people who say, gosh, living two doors down from me is somebody you're looking for. Mm. And it's going to be a very slow process. I mean, my honest guess is that this will be a very slow process to try to weed out a few people from the 25 million in Iraq. And ultimately, we probably won't get our hands on that many of them.
Though, General Ruppert, the word coming from Washington is very specific. They're saying these people involved in war crimes will not go to an international court. Neither the U.S. or Iraq are party to the international court, they say. It will be military commissions, military courts-martial, or civilian federal courts.
My view is that 80% of the announcement that you're looking at is intended to prevent future actions of this type rather than to respond to the actions that have taken place. We will still have a number of people in harm's way. We want to send a clear message to those who might conduct themselves in that way that they will be held accountable.
We're talking about turning the corner from war to peace. Colin Powell says the hostilities phase is coming to an end. John's calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
Good evening. I have a question that has to do with this concept of liberation and of bringing our ideals of democracy to Iraq. And I'm wondering whether there is a place in this new Iraqi society for women, and whether our liberation includes liberating women from the oppression that they've had to suffer. And I would note that when we quote-unquote liberated Kuwait, we didn't do a thing for the women there, and they're returned to their state of servience to men. Is that something that...
John, your line's breaking up, but I think we've got it. Here's a question that echoes very strongly also from Afghanistan. Daryl Press, what about it? It raises the specific issue of whether or not there's something that the U.S. forces ought to be doing about Iraqi women. And I guess the larger question is, how much cultural intervention beyond civic intervention should be on the U.S. plate post-war?
That's a very tough question. You know, fundamentally, I don't think there is an answer. I guess the way I think about this is that the United States, in terms of its values, has lots of things it would like to see happen in Iraq in the future. Most importantly, we want to see, from a values standpoint, an Iraq that's free of, you know, mass torture and mass brutality that the Ba'ath regime was so guilty of. How far down the list we get into kind of creating a society that's fair by our standards, it's not clear how far we will go, or even, as John suggests, how far we want to go, because at some point, as you get down this list, our values start running up against deeply held cultural values in the Middle East, especially with regards to women. So exactly how we square that circle, which of our values we really try to enforce as they establish their own sort of government and society, that I really couldn't answer.
General Ruppert, I can see this becoming an issue very quickly. In Afghanistan, it was perhaps more obvious, because the head-to-toe burqa was a big symbol there, and as far as I know, the status and treatment of women was remarkably more out of step with America than in Iraq, where I think a kind of secular tradition is much stronger than certainly recent Afghanistan. But do you see that kind of cultural intervention by the U.S. military? Is it inevitable?
Certainly it will be inevitable that we will tell them what values that we hold, but we will be incapable of imposing our values on them if they do run counter to their culture. We have to account for their history, their experience, and encourage them in directions we want. If we impose those values on them, they will be very shallow in the first place and ineffective in the end.
So here we are sitting tonight with U.S. troops sleeping in a presidential district inside Baghdad. It's kind of a remarkable point. Colin Powell, with his interesting phrasing, General Ruppert, you're not accepting that entirely. It's too soon to call it the end of the hostilities phase. But something big is happening, has already happened. Darrell Press, won't we see a kind of checkerboard effect in Iraq, where you may have areas that are still hot and other areas that begin to transition into something much more like a move to civilian life again?
That's definitely possible, because there's a big difference probably in the end game between the words and the deeds. From the standpoint of words, we do hope that we get somebody to surrender, even if we have to bring in an Iraqi government of our own to surrender to us. But even when that happens, the deeds on the ground might be very different. I mean, the war will fundamentally be over when large numbers of loyalists stop fighting in Baghdad, and this might be a gradual process as some of them are killed, some of them surrender, some of them just melt away. So I think you're exactly right. This might be a gradual process toward the end of the war rather than a distinct line.
And General John Ruppert, what's your level of confidence about this next phase, when it comes, compared to the first war-fighting phase? Is the military, the U.S. military, as well-equipped for what's coming as it apparently has been for the fighting so far?
I think that's the real question, and that will be at the heart of the issue. If you remember the war-fighting phase, 90% of our victories were psychological. Once they saw the military might, the dedication, and the capabilities of the American and the British forces, they said, we're not going to fight this battle. We know what the outcome is. That's certain. If the Americans, and I believe they are, and the British, are as dedicated and as capable as to building as they were to breaking, it will also win the confidence and support of the Iraqi people, and they will win a psychological victory in the same sense by gaining their support and trust.
They're going to have to show them in a hurry. We read reports of individual towns and cities in Iraq kind of turning sour within 3 or 4 days when they haven't got the supplies, the relief that they're hoping for behind U.S. troops. Big challenge lies ahead. General John Ruppert, I want to thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
General John Ruppert is a retired Brigadier General in the U.S. Army, nearly 33 years of active duty there. He's now Executive Director of Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And Darrell Press in Hanover, New Hampshire, thank you for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Darrell Press is professor of government at Dartmouth College. For the past 8 years, he's been consulting to the U.S. Defense Department on military planning for the Persian Gulf. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the search for chemical weapons in Iraq. This is On Point. Preliminary field tests today gave U.S. troops a positive reading on what they say might be barrels of mustard gas and nerve agent at two sites near Karbala. The initial tests are not conclusive, and officials are cautioning that the barrels could just contain pesticides. If the barrels do contain chemical warfare agents, they would begin to substantiate one of the Bush administration's main arguments for invading Iraq. Joining me now to discuss developments in the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is former UN weapons inspector Rocco Casagrande. He was former chief of the biological analysis lab for UMNOVIC, the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission that returned from Iraq last month. He's currently director for Homeland Security Programs at Apt Associates. Good evening and welcome, Rocco Casagrande.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you've no doubt heard the same reports we have at an agricultural facility southwest, I believe, of Baghdad. U.S. forces found barrels of chemicals, some of them camouflaged and apparently seemed to be somewhat hidden. They brought in their equipment. I don't understand the technology, but they got a positive reading. You're the weapons inspections guy and the chemical and biological guy. How credible does this sound to you? Does this sound like a potential nerve agent, or have we just got a barrel of DDT that set off the alarm?
Well, detectors that is commonly used in the military, the so-called CAM, will respond to most chemicals that have sulfur or phosphate in them, organic phosphates in them. And so this could be anything. It's very likely that many pesticides, such as malathion, will set it off.
So is this what we saw on television? It looks like kind of some handheld device with a big silver point at the end, and what does it do? It picks up ambient molecules of sulfur, as you say?
Right. It has an air intake on it, and it sucks the chemicals in, and it analyzes them in one of several ways. It analyzes them when it gets into the detector.
So, Rocco Casagrande, you've no doubt seen the footage that we've seen. Does this look like a serious inspection effort underway? Does it impress you as a chemical weapons inspector as a proficient scouring for the chemical weapons that, of course, U.S. troops are looking hard for?
Well, the snippets you see on the news really don't tell you enough about how they're going about searching. Are they, searching a room completely, or do they just break in and, see a barrel in front of them? An actual inspection doesn't make very good theater, because mm-hmm. It's searching a room about the size of a large garage. If you're doing it thoroughly and it's a cluttered room, it could take as long as 45 minutes.
What are you thinking as you hear these reports tonight? You've been there only a month ago and have inspected yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Washington will come up with evidence of chemical and biological weapons material or not, Rocco Casagrande?
I do think they will. For 12 years, Iraq was suffering sanctions and other political penalties because it was blocking inspections. And it was blocking inspections for some reason. The most likely conclusion one would draw is that they didn't want the inspectors to find something.
So if you were looking, where would you look?
Well, I was there for 3 months, and I didn't turn up any smoking guns as far as finding any barrels of chemicals myself, so maybe I'm not the best person to ask.
But industrial facilities, agricultural facilities, totally hidden facilities?
Well, totally hidden facilities are the ones the inspectors didn't have access to. We had access to any industrial or agricultural facilities we decided we wanted to go to. However, we didn't search primarily schools that didn't have anything to do with the mandate, and there could be weapons stored there. They just probably wouldn't be produced there, but they might be stored there.
A lot more searching to go on. Rocco Casagrande, thank you for joining us tonight.
No problem.
Rocco Casagrande is former chief of the Biological Analysis Lab for the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission. He was in Iraq from December 8th last year to March 4th last month. He's now director of Homeland Security Programs for Apt Associates. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.